Education Day. Some of you can only come for one day, some of you come for both days, and some don't come for any day. Unlucky people. So, further meditation, many of you have come here almost every year, every time I've been teaching meditation here, which shows you how bad a teacher I am, because if I was a really good teacher, you'd only need to come once, and you'd all be enlightened, you would never need to come again. So, I often say, if this was a school, and I was a school teacher, and the students kept coming back, the same students kept coming back to my class year after year after year after year, I would be kicked out. But meditation is not just the same as ordinary teaching. It's more like a coach teaching a person just how to play football or tennis or cricket. It's actually learning these skills rather than imparting knowledge. And so because it's learning skills, it does take much more time in order to be able to do what we call meditate. And the basic principles of meditation are actually very, very easy to understand, but hard to perform. All it is just letting go. Now, of course, that's difficult because it goes against everything else you've ever been trained at since you were born. Many of you had great potential as meditators. Maybe in grade one or grade two, your teacher said, "What do you think about that?" And you said, "Nothing." And you got into trouble. You could have been a great meditator and your skills were compromised by our culture, which says we should always think about something, give an opinion about it, do something about it, and if you don't strive, you won't get anywhere in this world. And so we become great strivers. Unfortunately, that doesn't help at all when it gets to meditation. Here in the BSV, there are many traditional Buddhists who went to little Dharma schools when you were tiny, and there you learned much about the Buddha's teachings. But when it comes to meditation, all those teachings go out the window, and we strive. So please understand, first of all, that in the story of the life of the Buddha, for 6 years, the Bodhisattva strived and strived and strived much harder than even Arnie Schwarzenegger and still didn't get enlightened, just like Arnie Schwarzenegger is not enlightened. But put forth incredible effort and got to the point of frustration, and sooner or later all willpower leads to frustration. Because you find there are some things in your body, in your mind, in this world, which you just cannot control. And you get frustrated. So that's what happened to the Buddha. And according to all the accounts, this is in the Mahasatika Sutta 36 of Majjhima Nikaya. Sometimes people think that I just tell jokes, but I'm a scholar as well. So every now and again I have to quote something just to give me some cred in Buddhist circles. There, the Buddha recounted his journey and said that he was so frustrated after 6 years of striving. He wondered, how on earth can you get enlightened? How can you end suffering when through this maximum effort he was getting nowhere? And that's when he recalled, under a rose apple tree as a 7-year-old boy, while his father was doing a plowing ceremony, the first tilling of the soil for the season, and being a young man, bored, nothing much to do, if he was a young 7-year-old boy when his father was doing some ceremony these days, he'd be probably playing video games on his iPhone. But fortunately, there were no iPhones or video games in the time of the Buddha, so he couldn't escape doing that. So So just sitting under the cool shade of a tree, he closed his eyes and meditated. And he got into what we call the first jhana. Now sometimes you wonder how a seven-year-old boy could do that, and obviously it was because of past lives. Still a tendency to recall, if not in detail, recall some of the ways of living. And you always remember, for those people who do recall the past lives, that they tend to disappear after 7 or 8 years. You can remember them clearly when you're very young, but then your new life tends to take over. Like one of our committee members in Perth, she's Sri Lankan through and through, but when she gave birth to her first child, as soon as the child could do anything, insisted on using chopsticks and insisted on eating Chinese food. I think she was in Colombo at the time. And that was really weird. It was obviously sort of the first child was Chinese in a previous life from somewhere or other. But after a few years, that disappears. And you take on all of the characteristics, you know, of your new life. And so it's to be noted that that thing happened at 7 years of age, almost like the Bodhisattva could recall, if not in detail, just how to meditate and get into a deep meditation, a jhana. And he forgot about that afterwards, which is also what happens when a person gets older. They lose their memories and skills of a previous life if they're not developed again. And tried his asceticism, but he remembered that time. And according to the suttas, very well accepted as the most accurate, authentic record of the Buddha's actual words, he said, maybe that is the way to Bodhi. Now Bodhi is a word which we say enlightenment, but it's more accurate to translate it as awakening. It comes from the Pali word bujjati, which does mean to really wake up, mean really wake up. So that may be the way to Bodhi. And then he said the insight came to him. That is the way to Bodhi. But he said it's so hard to get a peaceful mind when the body is so sore, aching and weak after so many years of asceticism. So that's why he decided to have a good meal, have a rest, a bathe, which was considered to be a luxury in those days, and to find a nice place to meditate when he was fit and healthy. And that was really important to me to understand that that became the first teaching of the Buddha after his enlightenment called the middle way, to avoid asceticism. So we have a room here with an air con, so you don't have to suffer excessive heat or cold. Now of course you can't get it perfect. Me, I was made in England, so I prefer cold. If I had control of the air cons, I'd turn them off, or actually probably put them into the cooling mode and open all the windows. But many of you were MIS, made in Sri Lanka. Which means you like it warm, if not there, in other parts of Asia. So we try and make it as best as possible. Of course, in the perfect meditation hall, we would have individual air cons. You just pull them down, and you can set the temperature just around yourself. Wouldn't that be wonderful? I'm sure that if you can think about it, one day it would actually happen. I often wondered about meditation cushions. These are just so last century. I saw these in the 1990 and 1980 even, these ones. Why can't we have high-tech meditation cushions with a remote control? So if your bottom is a bit too cold, you can warm it up, just like those toilet seats I see in Korea and Japan when I go there. If it needs to be raised, you can press another button and it inflates and you raise it up. One under your legs, if you need that one to be raised up. Maybe if it comes a bit sore, you can press another button and massages it. And if ever you have stress and torpor, you press another button and you get a cup of espresso or latte, whichever you key in there. Wouldn't that be high-tech meditation cushions? Come on! Some entrepreneur, mindfulness, which is the same as meditation, so famous now, so well used. There is a great business opportunity for high-tech modern meditation cushions, and 10% goes to Newbury Buddhist Monastery, who needs money to build their new, their new temple. So anyway, but doesn't matter how comfortable it gets, you'll never be perfect, but you give it everything you've got to try and make this body comfortable. You don't endure, which is using willpower. You use wisdom power, which is totally different. So the first thing in meditation is always getting your body nice and comfortable in a reasonably peaceful place, in a place which is not too disturbing. And the reason is because you want to settle your body down. Here we go. I was going to say this much later, but I'm sure I'll come up to this much later on. The first part of the meditation always has to be calming things down, settling. It's called samatha. A lot of times people call that serenity, but the word samatha, the way it's used, is not just for meditation. The last seven rules for the Bhikkhu Patimokkha, these are 227 rules which monks have to keep, are called the seven business samatha rules. The samatha means a way of settling any business which needs to be done. Just like in committees, you have a resolution, you've got to settle it. That's called samatha, settling the business, so it doesn't need to be thought about again. If you understand that meaning of the word samatha in a practical sense, you understand just how we have to settle the business of our body, first of all. Making sure it's not thirsty, you have enough drinks beforehand, you don't need to go to the toilet, please go before you come in. And that it's reasonably comfortable. Because when you can settle the body down, and it hasn't got so many aches and pains, then your body can disappear. The job of samatha, of calming things down, is to bring it to a place of stillness. And stillness is not the end of the process. Stillness is where things begin to vanish. So your body just disappears. This is what it's supposed to do. And you get to the disappearance by making your mind, body calm. And first time I started figuring this out, you know, people tell you, you learn, but there's nothing better than experience to teach you what's really going on. And sometimes that experience comes in weird ways, in situations where you don't expect it. And that was a time when I went to a meditation retreat in the Zen tradition. And this was in UK, still a student, and you couldn't choose what Buddhist community you joined because there wasn't enough of them. So the local one, I didn't care what tradition it was, that's where I went. And when I was staying in the north of England, the closest monastery or retreat center was a place called Throstle Hole in Northumberland, I think it was. And I went there for a meditation retreat one weekend. And we had to sit facing the wall with our eyes open. I'd never done that before because usually you close your eyes. But you're willing to give anything a go. And the teacher, the master, would walk down the aisle with the big Zen stick. And if you nodded, if you moved a small amount, whack! I never got hit, not once. It was not that I wasn't sleepy. It was because I was always blessed in this life with some very good karma. Always been a very lucky man and a lucky monk. Good karma. Because my good fortune on that occasion was the young man sitting next to me was nodding more. So he got hit first. Whack! And as soon as I heard that, all my sleepiness vanished totally. I was so terrified and frightened. But that's not the way to meditate from fear, but you know, that's worked for me, I suppose. But sitting there with your eyes open, watching just a whitewashed wall, like you know, the green wall here, so light green, pastel, just watching that, there's no adornments on it, you just sit there watching it. And then the strange thing happened. The wall vanished. It just disappeared from existence. Now many people would get afraid. But for me, this was the late 60s, early 70s, just when anything weird was the coolest thing ever. And that is why I joined places like the Psychic Research Society in Cambridge. I wasn't scared of ghosts, we went looking for them. Anyone who said there was a ghost in the house, we'd all go down and spend the night there, trying to find one. So, weird stuff was really interesting. So when a wall disappeared, it literally just was there one moment and then vanished. There was nothing there, it's gone. And, you know, that was weird and I just stayed there, enjoying it, but also contemplating, why? What's happening? Am I going crazy? Did they put some drugs in my porridge that morning? Why? What happened? And of course, you know, being in a Buddhist place, we don't take any drugs. What was happening there was quite easy to understand through a little bit of science, that your eyes only respond to things which change. If nothing alters, nothing changes, the sense of sight just turns off. It's so similar to modern computers. If you don't click the screen or touch the screen or click the mouse, you go into the screensaver and then it just turns off. Your brain is so similar. It's only wired to notice things which change. And if nothing's changing, after a while, it turns off. It's the same as when you close your eyelids. When I close my eyelids, I see the inside of my eyelids, first of all. Only for a couple of seconds, maybe a bit longer if there's a bright light outside and it appears red. But after a few seconds, minute at most, I can't see anything. I can't see darkness or the inside of my eyelids. Nothing is happening there, so the sense of sight turns off. It's one of the reasons why we try to sit in a room which is peaceful, where there's not much noise. Can you hear the sound of the air con now? How long for? In a few seconds you won't be able to hear it anymore. Or whatever it is, making a noise, a fan. After a while you won't hear that anymore, because it doesn't change. It's constant. Even the hum of the traffic in the background, after a while you won't hear it. The most important thing is that if you do have to come in and go out, please don't make a sound. You can do that. Even burglars can do that. They can come in and out of your house. They can open doors and no one hears them. There is a famous story of a couple of my so-called disciples. They were Malaysian Chinese Buddhists. I think there's a few of them in here today. They were watching a movie at home. It must have been an incredible movie because only when the movie had stopped And they went out to go to the toilet and make a cup of tea. Only then did they realize that many things in the room in which they were sitting had vanished. And this was not a meditation experience. This was the fact that the burglar, the really cheeky burglar, had been into their house, into their lounge room, while they were watching the TV. And even on the shelves, right behind the sofa, the burglar had nicked many sort of expensive things. And they hadn't heard him at all, or her. Now if a burglar can come into your house without disturbing you, without banging the doors or making any noises, surely you'll be able to come in and out of this hall without making a noise. You can come and no one hears you coming. You can go and no one hears you going. Burglars are not refined people, but they can do that. Surely you can. So during the meditation, if you do need to get in, come in or go out, please remember, do the burglar meditation. So quiet that no one knows you've left and no one knows you've come. So, at the very least you learn one new trade, because many people are losing their jobs in this economic climate. So at least you can learn a new trade. But I don't mean burglary. If you learn how to be mindful, maybe you can work for ASIO. Anyway, learning how to be calm and quiet is important, so that the sense of sound can disappear. And then, what else have you got? Smell. There are some people in this world, they have digestion problems. Sometimes they pass wind. And so I ask people, and that actually changes the smell in the room. So I do ask if there are any people with indigestion who have eaten too many beans this morning. Please, out of compassion, sit in the back. Because if you sit in the back row, there's no one behind you, only the wall. So no one can smell you. But if you sit in the front, you don't have to move up to the back of the wall. Ah, she's very compassionate. If you sit right in the front, so many other people have to smell you. So now we know why the people sitting in the back are sitting in the back. That's only messing around, but you know that smell just is the same. So it's a very easy one, smell. And the same as taste, that's an easy one to shut down. But the hard one of all is our body. To get that so calm and peaceful and stable that it vanishes. So we can reveal the sixth sense, which is the mind. Sometimes I get frustrated with scientists who start to tell you all about the brain and the nature of consciousness, and they just don't know what the heck they're talking about, because they never experienced what happens when the five senses vanish. And it's not nothingness. Is the mind, the sixth sense, is left. Now this is a very fundamental reason for the malaise in our societies. We're a materialist society. And that's not just with getting stuff, big houses, cars, worrying about possessions. It's also materialist philosophy as well, which does not include a mind, a heart in it. And we'd lost that for a couple of hundred years. And I always go back to the myth, having being a Westerner, educated Westerner, the myth that all the good stuff in society started in Greece. And philosophy, the philosophy which underpinned science, started there. And that's total BS. I will mention this word once and not again. No, bullshit. Because it's not apparently appropriate for a monk to speak that word. So I have my trick. I use a Pali translation of that word because the word bull in Pali is called go, G-O. And what comes out of the back end of a bull is called mayang. So every time I use the word go mayang, you know what I'm referring to. Go mayang. It's the word bullshit, but in Pali. So that means I don't get into trouble. So it's total go mayang to think that this mind doesn't exist. And you're going to find this out, exactly what it is and how it works and what it is. And with the direct experience, you know, of this sixth sense of mind, all this stuff about, you know, rebirth becomes so obvious, the importance of this mind, and actually the freedom of this mind becomes so obvious to you. This was one of my similes. There was once an emperor, and this emperor was very, very powerful. The problem was that no person knew who this emperor was, whether it was male or female, old or young, whether it was Caucasian, Asian, South Indian, or whatever, African. No one knew because they'd never seen the emperor. All they'd ever seen when the emperor appeared in public was this figure dressed in the five garments. The emperor would have these huge boots which would go cover his feet obviously and go right up to his thighs. The emperor would wear these trousers which went over the top of the boots to his ankles and way high up to his waist, and wore a jacket which overlapped the top of the trousers, with sleeves going way down to the wrists and a high neck, and wore gloves which overlapped the end of the sleeves, and lastly a helmet which totally covered the face and overlapped the top of the jacket. These five pieces of clothing gave no indication of what was underneath it. The boots, the trousers, the jacket, the gloves and the helmet. So no one knew. They couldn't even see to perceive what this emperor was. And that's my simile of the mind and the five senses. Every time this mind, the emperor, appears, it's always covered in either sight, sound, smell, taste or touch. You don't really know what it is. So the only way to discover the true nature of the emperor is to take those five pieces of clothing off, to see the emperor in the nude, not covered at all. And that's what we do in meditation, to actually to be so still that sight disappears, sound vanishes, smell, taste, and even the physical touch disappears, and see what is left. And I mention the Greek philosophy because even Aristotle said there are six senses. The six senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, taste and touch, plus the mind, the knowing. Aristotle said that. And he also mentioned that that mind was called the common sense. Because whatever you hear, see, smell, taste, touch, the mind also knows. It's common to all the other five. That is Greek philosophy on basis of which people say modern science has its foundation. It doesn't. It's a myth because over 2,000 years since Aristotle, our Western civilization has lost its mind. It's abandoned its common sense. And that is the reason for many troubles. Materialist philosophy, materialist science, materialist world. Stuff more important than hearts and feelings. and even kindness. We measure our country's progress by how much stuff we produce, not how kind our hearts are. It's materialism. So we're going to try and change that. Getting people in touch directly with their sixth sense, the mind. Sometimes people ask me, they asked me this recently in Perth, where is the mind? Is it in your heart? Is it in your head? Is it in your left big toe? Where is it? And the answer was given many, many, many years ago by a young English philosopher, only 5 years of age. The wisdom of kids who haven't been taught how to think like others, who can, as they say, think outside the box totally. And this was the daughter of one of my best friends. I saw her last time I was over in England. She, grade one at school, was asked a question by the teacher. I think I said this the first day here. I give so many talks, I don't know what I said when. Yeah. But she was asked, what is the biggest thing in the world? And one kid, grade one at school, put up their hand. My daddy is the biggest thing in the world. And if you've had a 5-year-old kid, you understand just that's what they would say, because to them the daddy is huge. Another kid, no, miss, an elephant is much bigger than her daddy, just been to the zoo. No, miss, a mountain is bigger than an elephant. That's getting somewhere. And then this 5-year-old, who later did postgrad research in Oxford in biochemistry or something. She's brilliant at 5 and just carried on that brilliance. No, miss, my eye is the biggest thing in the world. This is thinking outside the box. What do you mean? Eye is the biggest thing in the world, the eye. Well, ma'am, my eye can see her father. My eye can see an elephant, my eye can see a mountain and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. And that's wonderful logic. It's seeing things from a different angle. And that was so profound, my friend wrote the letter to me and told me that in Thailand. And I wrote back to him and say, 9 out of 10, but you didn't get it totally right. But really good. Because your mind can see everything your eye can see. And it can imagine things you'll never see in the real world. Your mind can also hear sounds, real and imaginary. It can smell, it can taste, it can feel. Real, like imaginary feelings, like phantom limbs. And it can also know, it's got its own area. Your emotions, your feelings, your thoughts, ideas. In fact, everything you will ever experience, everything you can ever experience, all of that can fit into your mind. So your mind is the biggest thing. Stop. Not the biggest thing in the world, because your world, all worlds, can fit into your mind because it can be known. So when you ask where the mind is, the answer is the world is in the mind, not the mind is in the world. It's the other way around. And that is a great argument which no philosopher or scientist in all the years which I've mentioned that, written about it in books, has ever been able to find fault with. And that gives you a wonderful answer. But now we're going to find that mind, experiencing it directly, what it really is. That's why it's called an emperor. It's powerful. So in order to especially let this fifth sense, the body, disappear, we have to learn how to sit quite calm and peaceful. But that is not good enough. Many of you who've been coming to this place for a long time know Alfred in the back will remember. Remember Ajahn Chakro? I'm going to go and visit him next month in Chicago. I know he looks exactly the same. From head up, still bald head, looks exactly the same as he did when he was a monk. And he really helped this place out many, many years ago. And I mention him because when I first came to Australia, someone came to visit us and they said they had just imported the first flotation tank, you know, a sensory deprivation chamber. And they wanted us Buddhist monks to try it. And he went there first because he was senior. He always got the first. And he told me what it was like. He said you had to get some, he borrowed some bathers because you can't use your robes. And you went in this tank, you're floating in salt water. So you floated, you didn't sink. So you had no pressure on any part of your body whatsoever. And there was a body temperature. So actually you could hardly feel it. It wasn't cold, it wasn't hot. It was exactly the same temperature as your body. So you were floating in there with no pressure on any part of your body. And they closed it up so it was no light at all. It was pitch black, so you couldn't see anything. And it was soundproof, so you couldn't hear any external sounds. It was taking away all the five senses. So I thought, wow, how brilliant this is. And I asked him afterwards what it was like. I was really waiting to try it the next day. My appointment was next. But I never got to use it. Because the day after he'd been in this flotation tank, people showed us a big advertisement in the newspaper. Flotation tanks, $50 an hour or something, as used by Buddhist monks. They tricked us into using it so they could advertise as used by Buddhist monks. It was a scam. So he said, no, you can't use it. I said, oh, come on. You know, it's already been used by one monk. Can't I use it? He said, no. So I never got to have a try. But anyway, it wasn't really necessary because what, I remember Ajahn Chakro telling me, yeah, you were laying in there. It was light-proof, soundproof. You couldn't feel the body. The body was floating and it was warm. But, he said, the breath was so loud because everything else was taken away. And he said, that was so disturbing. So that is one of the problems. That when your body relaxes, there's always something going on. It's not totally still. It's the last thing moving when everything else vanishes. And that explains why we have breath meditation. If you sit down really comfortably, you've got nice cushions, your legs are relaxed, your body's relaxed, not too hot, not too cold, no sound. The only thing left, which is moving, is your breathing. So that's why we allow ourselves to focus on the breath, to calm it down. You can't not focus on the breath, it's natural. And calm it down. How does the breath calm down? Because you're not doing very much. If you're still doing stuff, it means your metabolism is going up. You need more oxygen, which means you have to breathe more. And one of the biggest drains of energy is your human brain. I think they said something, the last I saw, you may sort of correct me on this, but something like 35% of all the carbohydrates you burn is used for your brain activity. It's only a small organ but it uses an enormous proportion of your intake of energy. It's one of the reasons why I keep putting on weight, even though I don't eat that much. It is true, it's because I don't think very much. I'm a monk, I'm nice and peaceful. I don't burn those many calories through thinking. So really, if I want to lose weight, if you want to lose weight, the best thing to do is to worry about the government, the economy, the state of the planet. Think. It will drive you crazy, but you know, you'll lose weight. But it uses a huge amount of energy, the brain. So because of that, it uses a lot of oxygen, which means you have to breathe a lot. But when you really calm down, you're thinking, and it gets very still. It means you don't metabolize very much. You don't need much oxygen, which means your breath gets very soft, very even, until your breathing vanishes. It's gone. It's very weird. I like weird stuff. This is the story of my master Ajahn Chah. He had a stroke in his last years of life, so he couldn't speak. But he would still meditate. We knew that. This is one of the reasons why we knew he was still going into very deep meditations. Because even though the community of monks, after he had a stroke and couldn't speak anymore, they all met together and said, no medical intervention, he's done his service, let him die. But as soon as the King of Thailand heard that, he said, no, keep him alive. So the King of Thailand, the late King of Thailand, paid for a nurse, nurses on roster, male nurses, to be on duty 24/7. And with the male nurse was usually one or two monks doing service. And one of the monks told me this story. In the night time, Ajahn Chah stopped breathing. He wasn't breathing at all. It was a trained nurse on duty, not just monks. And the male nurse freaked out. We have to do something. The monk said, leave him alone, he's just meditating. No, he can't be. Leave him alone. The male nurse knew that one day everyone must die, including someone like an Ajahn Chah. But the nurse said, I don't mind him dying as long as it's not on my shift. Quite understandable. So he wanted to intervene. The monk said, leave him alone. And he did this. They came to a compromise. An amazing experiment, which, you know, because it wasn't done under laboratory situations, you know, can never be published. But this is actually what happened. The doctor said, well, look, as long as there's oxygen going to the brain, there'll be no brain damage. So he took blood samples every few minutes to make sure the blood was oxygenated. And over the period of a few hours, taking the blood samples, even though there was no breathing apparent whatsoever, the blood was always fully oxygenated. So there was no danger of brain damage. And no one knew how that oxygen was going in there because the heart was still pumping around, but without any breathing. And air was getting in there, or oxygen was getting in there somewhere. And obviously the brain was hardly using any oxygen. So a wonderful little experiment, many hours not breathing, and you were still perfectly okay. So this is actually what happened. You get so peaceful and still that the breath vanishes. It's actually, for most people, it's still going in and out, but so softly, because you're not using much oxygen. Your five senses have disappeared. And that's when people start to get what we call in meditation the nimittas, these beautiful lights which appear in the mind. You're not asleep, you're actually more awake than ever. This is why we call it Bodhi. You're wakening up, your mindfulness, your awareness is really increasing. And when it does, see these beautiful lights in the mind, you're actually seeing a reflection of your mind, the sixth sense, which is very wonderful and very powerful. And you can get some wonderful insights of what it actually is. Meditation goes much deeper, but this is where we start to get some really interesting stuff coming up. And of course, it's amazing for your health when you go to those. Usually, if you get out of your body, or rather leave the body alone, it disappears. It's amazing the health benefits this can give you. And it's also very happy, very blissful, very beautiful. You understand why we meditate to get to these stages. But it's all about sitting down, being calm, being still. Now the biggest problem people have with meditation is thinking too much. And so much of meditation is training on those early stages. Sitting comfortably is not too difficult. But then when you close your eyes, you can't just go and watch the breathing, because you have all these thoughts and fantasies and plans and memories come into your mind. And many people give up meditating because they can't stop thinking. And when I start talking about nimittas and the body disappearing, I said, oh, come on, Ajahn Brahm, we're not monks. Now come back to us. But it's not that hard to do, especially when you understand why those thoughts actually happen at all. Why do we think so much? Don't try and stop the thoughts through willpower. It just makes more thoughts. I was taught when I first started meditating, if you start thinking about something else, just bring the mind back onto the breath and carry on watching the breath. And if it goes away again, bring it back. And that's what I thought the training was. After about 5 or 6 years of bringing it back, and it always goes off again, bringing it back again, always goes off again, bringing it back again, you realize, no, this doesn't work. And this is basic Buddhist teachings. Don't use willpower. Understand, why does your mind keep wandering off? Why does it wander off? Why can't it stay with you? And the answer comes from these little anecdotes. There was a mother over in Perth who told me that a 6-year-old son one day told her, Mummy, I don't love you anymore, I want to leave home. He had an argument with the mummy. And this mother was such an amazing, wise person. She, you know, was almost like a Nobel laureate in emotional intelligence, in how to bring up a kid especially. Mummy, I don't love you anymore, I want to leave home, said the 6-year-old. So mummy said, okay, I'll help you pack. I know many of you thought that would be a good idea, but she actually did it. She helped pack her little 6-year-old son's bag with all the important things of life, the Spider-Man costume, the teddy bear, all the necessities. And before she would let the 6-year-old out of the house, she said, oh darling, before you go, I'll make you a sandwich for your lunch. So mummy made her 6-year-old her favorite peanut and jam sandwich, put it in a little brown paper bag, went to the door of the house and waved her son off. Darling, I wish you all the best in your life. Don't forget to write every now and again or call. All the best, son. Bye. And the little son walked, you know, in the house down the little path to the gate, you know, carrying a little brown paper bag and a little suitcase with all the essentials of life. Opened the gate, turned to the left and went down the road into its life. Left home for the first time. 6 years of age. It got about 50 meters, 100 meters. By which time the son was terribly homesick. Turned around, walked back to the gate, opened the gate, down the path, and the mother hadn't left the doorway. Welcome back, son. Now that was such, it really happened, don't make it up, really great emotional intelligence. let the son go. Don't say, no, you're too young to leave home. No, you get into trouble. I can't let you do that. Don't be naughty. Wait till your father comes home. All those sorts of threats. That's not emotional intelligence. You know the son won't go that far. It's home. You know, it's all these lovely things in there. So you let it go, bye-bye. It doesn't go that far and it turns back and comes back again. Welcome home. Problem solved. So what do you do? What did I used to do? As soon as my mind wanders off, grab it by the arm, don't you do that again, come back. So now I don't do that anymore. If my mind wants to wander off, I pack its bag, make it a sandwich. Bye. You know what happens then? It doesn't want to leave anymore. You know, realize, wow, this is a really nice guy. Now why do I want to run away from this guy? But if you're a control freak, always shouting at your kid, don't you ever do that again, rah! Of course your kid wants to run away. But if you have loving kindness towards your kid, and the kid here is my mind, when I have loving kindness and I treat it beautifully and kindly, my mind never wants to run away. The only reason why your mind runs away is because you've got a bad relationship with it. That's the only reason why. If you had this beautiful kindness, mind, the door of my heart's open to you. If you're sleepy, that's fine. If you're restless, that's fine with me. I care for you, I'm kind to you. And then your mind never wants to leave. Stays with you. The other simile was someone, the telephone call. Someone gives you a call. It may be sort of a holiday period, like Anzac Day. I can't resist telling the Anzac Day joke. There was an Englishman, an Irishman, a Scotsman, and an Australian. And they were in the pub one day. And the Englishman said, today all the drinks are on me. I'll pay for the drinks because this morning my wife gave birth to my first child, a son. And because today is St. George's Day, the patron saint of England or whatever, I decided to call my son George. 23rd of April, St. George's Day, so it's George. And the Scotsman said, wow, that is really weird. Because my first son was born on St. Andrew's Day, patron saint of Scotland. So I call my son Andrew. Wow, said the Irishman, my first child was born on St. Patrick's Day, so we called him Patrick, Paddy for short. And the Australian said, wow, this is just such a coincidence. Because my first son was born on Anzac Day, so we called him Biscuit. That's an original Ajahn Brahm joke. You know, sometimes people tell you these jokes and they go around the internet, you wonder where they came from. Yeah. Now you know, some of them are Ajahn Brahm jokes as well. Stupid things. It's not bad. But I did not tell that on Anzac Day because I get in big trouble. Someone will be offended and I'm not being patriotic or whatever. But anyway, where was I before saying this? I'm talking about, oh yes, right, thinking too much and not being kind to yourself. This was the story of the telephone call. So you get a telephone call, say Anzac Day, you got a free day, and somebody calls you up and says, you'd like to come out for a cup of coffee. Are you free this afternoon? Say, yeah, I'm free this afternoon. Okay, we're going to go to Gloria Jean's, because I like Gloria Jean's. And you're going to have a latte, because I like latte. And you're going to have a biscuit, not a chocolate chip muffin. And you have a biscuit, because that's what I like. And we're going to talk about politics, because, you know, that's really important. And we're going to stay there for 1 hour. And we're going to sit in the back, not in the front where you like to sit, in the back where I like to sit. And if you receive a telephone call like that, from someone who tells you what coffee shop you're going to go to, what you're going to drink, what you're going to eat, where you're going to sit, what you're going to talk about, for how long, what would your reaction be? You think, how can I get out of this? I say, oh, crikey. You don't, no one likes to be with a control freak, telling you what to do, where to do it, and, you know, and what to talk about. So you say, oh, yes, I've got this dentist appointment. I forgot totally about it. I'm terribly sorry. Maybe next week. And to keep your precepts, as soon as you get off the phone, you ring the dentist to make the appointment. And as soon as you finish making the dentist appointment, you get another phone call from another friend. They said, are you free this afternoon? Oh, I was terribly sorry. I just made a dentist appointment. I said, oh, that's terribly. Because you're always talking about this amazing little coffee shop, you know, just over in Carlton. And what's that road called? Sorry? Yeah, there we go. I actually was taken there once. So, beautiful independent coffee shop. And they're just long blacks or short blacks. You know, I tell you, I don't go out to these places. I don't know what coffee is. They're to die for, and their chocolate chip muffins are just the closest thing to Nirvana. And I know you always like to sit in the front, so I'll sit in the front with you as well on the street. And you've always been talking about this Buddhism stuff. You know, I've usually not been interesting, but you know, it's getting popular. Let's just talk about Buddhism. And if somebody invites you to your favorite coffee shop to drink the coffee which you like, to eat the muffins which you adore, and to talk about what really interests you, what would you say? He'd say, I'll be there in half an hour, I'm cancelling the appointment. You go there, and you'll end up sitting there much longer than an hour, all afternoon, because you're enjoying the company of somebody who's not a control freak. Now that is my simile for meditation. You tell your mind, right, you're going to watch the breath. And you're going to do it this way, not the way you usually do it. And you're going to do it for 45 minutes, not 40, if it doesn't matter, 45 minutes, no longer. If you order your mind like that, no wonder it tries to make an excuse to escape from you. It runs away because you're telling it what to do, how long to do it for, and how to do it. If you understand what I'm talking about here, you understand why people can't just stay in this moment. You're forcing it, controlling it, telling it what to do. So the trick is, always have some compassion and kindness in your meditation. Mind, if you want to fall asleep, fine by me. If you want to think, that's fine. Then you don't think, you don't fall asleep. Your mind says, anyone is just so kind and so wonderful, I want to hang out with them. So over the years, I have developed this wonderful attitude towards my mind. So whenever we see each other in meditation, it's like I spend so much time talking to people and having my photograph taken. But when I close my eyes, the mind says, yay, he's back again. So we just chill out together. My mind and I, best friends, we just hang out together. No force, no control, just enjoyment of one another's company. That is how it works. Never force a meditation. Please use kindness. Sometimes I notice people force meditation in some of these meditation techniques, and afterwards, when people go home, they're a pain in the ass for the people they live with. They've been controlling their body and mind all day. When they go home, they control their kids, their husband, their wife. Have you ever seen that? People go back from some meditation courses, and they're worse than when they left. That's because, yeah, they've been so-called meditating, but with force. And that force carries on to the people they're supposed to love. If you do the meditation properly with kindness, you go back home a much kinder, softer person. Which is why so often people come to my meditation evenings and these in work days, Tuesdays, Wednesdays. And they tell me, I've heard this story so many times, but I always share it. I never felt like coming to meditation this evening. I had a busy day at work. I just wanted to relax in front of the TV. And the only reason I came this evening is because my kid told me to come. Mommy, are you going to meditation tonight? No, darling, I feel tired. Mommy, you must go to meditation. I'm too exhausted. Mommy, go to meditation. Why, darling? Because you're a much nicer mummy after you come back from meditation. Feedback from little kids. And that is so true. So that is how we meditate and why we meditate. And now we're going to do some meditation after a 15 minutes toilet break. So it's now 9:30. So those of you, I know there's always a queue outside the ladies' toilet, so any ladies, on your marks, get set, go. So instead we understand what causes those waves which we experience as thoughts, fantasies, worries or memories, even though we know we don't need to remember those things. We don't need to plan this right now. We don't need to dream and fantasize. And one of the causes I mention is because our relationship with our mind is one of master or mistress and slave. You think your body is your slave, tell it what to do. Your mind is your servant. Come on, focus. Stop that thinking. Wake up. Don't ever treat your mind like that. Treat it with kindness. A friend. Not a slave, or a maid, or a servant. And also, understand that's not going to get you anywhere. That creates more of the waves on the surface of the lake. The only reason why there's waves on that surface of the lake, something is agitating it. Something's making it move. This was my master Ajahn Chah. I always say this every year. He said, this is a leaf on a tree. It only moves because of the wind. If the wind stops, it still moves, but less and less and less until it becomes perfectly still, because that's its default state, its natural state to be still. It only moves because of the wind. The human mind, your mind, is naturally still. That's its default state. It only moves because of wanting something. That's the wind, wanting. If you want your mind to be still, it never is, because you're blowing it. If you want to wake up because you're sleepy, it never actually works. You're blowing on it. You're making those waves. So our job is to let it be. No wanting. Allowing it just to be. The opposite is called stress. When you want something, you're pulling your mind off into some place you want to be in the future. You're stretching the mind. I want to be still. Trying to move your mind, drag it into stillness in the future. Or if you have some worries about the past, it's always aversion, ill will, not happy with what happened. And that pulls you back into the past. So when you meditate, you start thinking about stuff you cannot change. And please never accept that myth you can learn from the past. You don't learn from the past, you get imprisoned by the past. You learn from the present. This is where wisdom arises, right now. The only place. So never think that, oh, justify going over the past because I can learn something from it. You don't. You learn from the present. So, I gave the simile of the guitar string. A guitar string, when it's stretched at both ends, when it's under stress, only then, when you pluck it, does it make a sound. The more it's stressed, the higher the sound. and the more disturbing. And I remember going to the auction for our Dhammasawa Nuns Monastery. And just to see the way the auctioneers work. They said, this is a beautiful property. We're going to start the bidding at, say, 1.2 million. 1.2 million. Can I hear 1.2 million? Can I hear 1.3 million? Can I hear 1.4K? 5 million? And you notice that that's how they do. They go faster and a higher tone. And that gets people really excited. The higher the tone, the more disturbing it is. The more stress in your mind, the higher the tone of your thinking. And it really gets really scary and exciting. But as you loosen your concerns about the past and your future, and when you start to let go, you don't want anything. Past, can't change it, no aversion, you let it go. The future, wait till it happens. Then, when something plucks the string, it's just got an average tone. It's not so exciting and disturbing. As you loosen, you're being pulled to the past or pulling to the future. It gets less and less loose, less tight. When you strike it, it's very low tone. You know, I use that one. This is a common psychology technique. If ever you're having an argument with somebody or they're arguing with you, you notice they speak very fast and very high-pitched. So to calm them down, to diffuse the situation, you speak very slowly in a very soft, low tone voice, and no one can get angry at all. It diffuses anger. You can actually control people with your voice. So this is when the string is very slack, hardly any sound comes out at all. But when the tension pulling you to the future, worried about what might happen, that's totally released. And when there's no pull to the past, the string is loose, not being pulled into the past or pulled into the future, then things happen to it. Someone coughs, they bang the door. A thought arises in the mind, but it doesn't reverberate. It stops right there, because your mind is as loose as a guitar string which hasn't been stretched. That reverberation are your thoughts. Loosen the past and the future, and then there's no noise at all. If you want to get somewhere in meditation, your guitar string is taut, pulled into the future. If you're still worried about what happened a few minutes ago, you want to go to the toilet and these people don't know what they were doing in there all this time, then you're being pulled into the past and you're still tense. You'll be thinking a lot. Loosen that up and thoughts stop. No fantasies, no dreams, because there's no tension on the guitar string of your mind. Okay, easy. Now we're going to do it. Half an hour meditation, and then we'll have a couple of questions and answers before lunch. And I will lead the first 5 or 10 minutes, just to get you focused, and then it's all up to you. So sitting down, first thing to do to get your awareness settled in the present moment, to get it focused inside of you, is to be aware of your position, what we call the posture. There is no magic posture which works for everybody every time. You find a posture by using mindfulness and kindness. Starting off with your legs, to be aware of the feelings in the legs, just ask yourself the question, how are you, legs? Like you're asking somebody else, how are you feeling today? When you ask a question, you get an answer. You can feel the legs. Now the next thing to know is, can you make those legs more comfortable? Talking about a comfort that you can maintain for 30 minutes. So move your legs. As you move them, still watching the feelings in the legs, you begin to notice whether moving them makes them more comfortable or less. You get this wonderful thing called feedback. And little by little, moving them this way, moving them that way, you can find the best possible position. And once your legs are settled, you can feel that this is as good as it gets, then check your bottom, your buttocks. Because sometimes people get these aches and pains sitting down simply because they don't even care about how your bottom feels. So check it out. How are you, bottom? Can I make you more comfortable? And every time I do this, there's always something I can do. I've got my robe is folded and biting into the flesh. Wow, that's better. Otherwise my bottom gets really sore. And then you check your back. Some people say you should have a straight back. Others say you should lean back on the backrest of the chair. Try both and see which one is better for you. Your mindfulness gives you feedback, and your kindness, your compassion, chooses the best option. Then your hands, where should they be put? On your knees, on your lap? Try both, see which one works. The awareness allows you to compare, and the kindness makes a choice. If you're not even aware, you're not really focusing your attention on your hands, you'll never know. And then I go up to my head, well balanced on the top of my neck, not too far forward, not too far back. What do I mean by not too far this way or that way? You find out. Put mindfulness on the feelings in your head until you know which is the best feeling. And then, awareness of the muscles around your eyes. I like doing this because if I am tense or tired, you can feel those muscles tighten up. Emotions are played out on the face. And around the eyes in particular, I can feel the tightness there. And it's not that hard to learn how to relax those muscles. So not being pulled. I'm doing that now. My awareness shows the muscles are actually relaxing. And relaxing. So your face is becoming loose. No frown lines. When your body is as relaxed as possible through adjusting the posture, I've developed this very helpful way of relaxing inside of yourself. To choose a part of your body which is still aching or tense. It could be some joints which have an ache or a pain or arthritis. It could be a tummy ache, could be an irritation in the sinuses. What is the most disturbing feeling in your body right now? Once identified, now you zoom in onto that feeling like on Google Earth. Fill your mindfulness just with that feeling, even though it's unpleasant. Remain with your attention on that disturbing feeling. And see if you can notice how it ebbs and flows, how it sometimes gets worse and sometimes gets better. Impermanence, change. Mindfulness can give you that feedback. And then start to experiment with your mental attitudes, how you look at that disturbing feeling. If you look with negativity, trying to get rid of it, you'll find it gets tighter and tenser. If you look at that feeling with kindness, letting it be, opening the door of your heart to this moment, unconditionally, you'll find that feeling gets easier, looser. This is a way I've developed to get rid of huge pains in the body. You just relax them away with mindfulness and kindness. Whatever disturbance you have in your body, focus on it. And with kindness, with letting go, see if you can take away that irritation. And soon comes a time to let the body go and to start focusing on the mind. In particular, what I call the peaceometer. How peaceful you are, even before you start watching the breath. So ask yourself the question, how peaceful is my mind, or how agitated is it? Give it a number from 1 to 10. 1 is peaceful, 10 is agitated. What number can you give it today? To be able to fulfill this request, you have to be aware of this part of your mind which I gave the name peaceometer to. It tells you how peaceful or how agitated you are. Once you have mindfulness of your peaceometer, discover what attitude of mind makes the peaceometer needle move up to more agitation, and what relaxes, moving the needle of the peaceometer closer and closer to one. What disturbs your mind? what increases and deepens the peace. As you get more and more peaceful, you'll find the thoughts get weaker and weaker. You'll discover that what makes the mind agitated is when it gets pulled to the past or dragged forward into the future. You let those go. You get so peaceful. So just keep watching the peaceometer and discover how to bring peace and stability to your inner world. Not wanting anything, just being here. And don't judge what you're aware of. Don't be critical. Just embrace this moment as it is. When you feel it's the right time to watch your breathing, just let the mind turn onto the breath. And as you breathe in naturally, imagine you're breathing in peace. As you breathe out, imagine you're breathing out, let go. Breathing in peace, breathe out, let go. I'm going to be quiet for the next 10 minutes till the meditation finishes. So getting close to the end of the meditation now. Before you open your eyes, ask yourself how you feel. How peaceful is the mind? And how relaxed is the body? It's a good time, if there are some questions to ask about the meditation. As I've often found that people do not put their hands up when it's to ask questions. And then afterwards, people line up to ask their questions. And it's such a shame because questions are just so helpful for everybody. So if you have a question, please ask it, and you will find most people pay attention because your question is the same as their questions. And just further forward, after lunch, when we come back at 1 o'clock, well, first at least half an hour, maybe longer, see how it goes, to do the question and answer session, where hopefully we can have some pieces of paper and you can write your questions on pieces of paper during the lunch period, which I will answer straight after we come back at 1 o'clock. The reason I do this is because at 1 o'clock the food will still be in your tummy, and if you try to meditate you'll fall fast asleep, many of you. It's just a natural thing. So I usually like to do questions and answers in the first period after lunch. Usually when I do conferences, they usually put me on the first presentation after lunch. It's always called the graveyard shift for delivering at a conference because people are really, they've been excited because of lunch and are sleepy. So they have to get someone who can tell funny stories, who can excite people, because I'm the only one who can keep people awake at that time. But anyway. Right now, are there any questions about the meditation they would like to ask? Wow, that's very quick.
Good morning, Ajahn Brahm. I would like to ask a question about the meditation getting popular in corporate America, especially in the IT tech industry. So if you look at companies like Google, Microsoft, LinkedIn, Facebook, all of them are actually quite encouraging in terms of introducing meditation into the corporate world, and certainly catching up a lot in America. Like for example, Thich Nhat Hanh and his monks actually advise the CEO of Salesforce in where to place meditation rooms in the new Salesforce building. And the Google, this Search Inside Yourself founder, Chad Ming Tan, had met three presidents of America. So obviously this catching up in America, and I'm just interested in your views of whether that's something that they're doing right, or whether there is something else they should improve on in terms of introducing meditation to the corporate world.
Yeah, very good. So just as you know, a couple of years ago, Chad Ming invited me into Google headquarters. I was actually advising him. Justin gave a talk at Google and also Facebook. I went to their meditation room as well. In Harvard Business School, they use my simile of how heavy is a cup. I won't go through it totally. The longer you hold it, the heavier it feels. So when it gets too heavy to bear comfortably, you put it down, let it go. And after a few minutes, you pick it up again, and then it feels lighter. It's classic stress reduction. Not lessening your workload, but knowing how when it gets a bit too uncomfortable, you give your brain and mind a rest. And that's classic in Harvard Business School now. So yeah, it does help. But of course, it doesn't get far enough, because there's not enough kindness associated with the mindfulness. It's just one of those other things which people try and make happen rather than let occur. And so that's one of the reasons why that there's still stress in places like Google and Facebook. The point is that it's good for corporate America because, and corporate Australia, because it does increase profits. Productivity goes up, and basically that's all they really think about. But I don't worry about that, because it's good that corporations' profits go up, because we need to get donations for the Newbury Buddhist Monastery. But what is happening now is it becomes just far too corporatized, and I was telling people, and I can see this happening. Mindfulness training is just so narrow, and to be a teacher in mindfulness, people are making huge money out of this. You have to go and get accreditation, go to courses. And now, because some of the mindfulness training, you can see this, that sometimes it's not done well, and there are some people who get psychotic episodes doing mindfulness, because it's done through force. You know, people don't really know what they're doing. Not like, you know, I've been trained as a monk for over 40 years. You know exactly what's going on. And I'm drawing on a tradition which has been going for 2,500 years. The wealth of experience and understanding is huge, which people in that culture don't have. But the problem is when there is problems, it becomes more regulated. And it's only going to be, I imagine, a few more years when I will not be allowed to teach meditation because I've got no accreditation. Like a doctor, you've got to go through so many years of training, accreditation. So there's a danger here somewhere. We're losing touch with our roots. But still, the last time I was over in the East Coast of the United States, I went to the offices of Shambhala Sun. I've got a good reputation now, so I can get entry into these places. And I haven't met John Kabat-Zinn, but they were just saying it was just there in the offices of where most of the publications are done in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And he said that, you know, he's a Buddhist, he's a meditator, and he is also concerned what monster he's created with this mindfulness movement. You know, it's really well-meaning. Take away, and I don't know why we have to do this, take away the religious part of it to make it secular. Why are people so ashamed or embarrassed about being Buddhist? It's a Buddhist practice, say it. It works. But it won't get so much usage. Yeah, you sure? So sometimes because of the fear, especially in the United States, the Christian lobby, that they would stop anything to do with Buddhism, anything to do with any other religion. So take away the religion from meditation, call it mindfulness. But I think that was not a good decision. So anyway, John Kabat-Zinn, one of the big founders and movers of this, is trying to bring back Buddhism into mindfulness. And introducing things like kindness, compassion, but also, like what many commentators have said, some morality, virtue, some precepts. Because as many people have noticed, even, don't talk about corporations, the US Army, the operators of remote control drones are taught how to be mindful, so that when they release those hellfire missiles on some unfortunates, they're very aware and mindful just to press it at the right time. What a bad use of mindfulness that is. So, sometimes I don't think it is going to help much if we don't bring in these other parts of Buddhism. It's a whole package. The virtue part, the wisdom part, the compassion part. Without that, the mindfulness is just trying to walk on one leg. So it is a concern. But these things usually look after themselves. People find out it's not really working as well as it should, and so we actually improve it. So, does that answer your question? Because that's a topical concern. Yeah.
Good morning. My question is regarding breath meditation.
Yeah.
So apart from using a breath as an object, can you use anything else?
Yeah, you can. There's so many different objects to use. So sometimes I start people by teaching them breath meditation. And if they can't do breath meditation, then I teach them Anapanasati. If they can't do Anapanasati, I teach them loving kindness meditation. And if they find difficulty with that, I teach them metta meditation. If they can't do metta meditation, I teach them like body scanning meditation. If they can't do body scanning meditation, I teach them vipassana meditation. If they can't do vipassana meditation, I teach them letting go meditation. If they can't do letting go meditation, I teach them like nekama sati meditation. If they can't do that, then I go and teach them breath meditation. By that time, they've forgotten that's where they first started. So basically, it doesn't matter at all. The one type of meditation which, if you want to just cut out all of the CLAP and go to the heart of it, is the Emperor's Three Questions meditation, which is a very beautiful way of meditating. The Emperor's Three Questions I wrote about in my first book, The Opening the Door of Your Heart. It comes from a collection of short stories by many distinguished Russian authors, which I read when I was a student, a long, long time ago. And it was really affected me. The background is that many of the intellectuals in, this was Imperial Russia, were really concerned about the treatment of the Jewish community there. And instead of just complaining about it, they decided to raise some funds by publishing a novel of short stories. Chekhov was in there, but Tolstoy, that's where he wrote his Emperor's Three Questions. And I've used this a lot. Mostly for ordinary life, but realized that it's excellent for meditation as well. Emperor was fed up with religion, always arguing and fighting wars with one another, so he wanted to ban religion and start a new one. And he's an emperor, you can do stuff like that. But he wanted to cut it down to the bare bone, the bare minimum. What is great for a spiritual life, which also works in your office and running an empire. So he came up, the only three questions you need to have answers for are when is the most important time, who is the most important person, and what is the most important thing to do. And they become the Emperor's Three Questions. The answers, after a long little story, were when the most obvious answer, when is the most important time, is now. It's the only time you have to do anything. Who is the most important person? When I was a student, knowing some psychology, I thought oneself, which was totally wrong. The right answer was just really blew me away and made me see things in a different way. The most important person is the one right in front of you, which right now is you, sir. You're the most important person to me. But now you're not, you are. What it is, it focuses you in this moment with who you're with. You don't try and get rid of somebody because you want to get onto somebody more important. The one right in front of you is always the most important person in the world. And the most important thing to do is to care, not to cure. This was my advice to doctors, because this doctor friend of mine, he came to me wanting to resign because he lost a patient in tragic circumstances, a young woman with a husband and two kids, and he had to be the one who told the husband, unexpectedly, his wife had died. He had no lover, no wife, and his children had no mother anymore. He said that just was so painful for him to tell. So painful, it was unendurable. He said, I cannot ever do that again. He felt such a failure. He let down big time the family. Even though he wasn't to blame, but we do tend to blame ourselves. And I told him, if you think your job as a doctor is to cure your patients, you'll fail many times. It's obvious, you can't always cure people. You'll feel a failure many times. But if you realize your main purpose as a doctor is to care for people, then you never ever need to fail. You can't stop them from dying, but you can always care for them in that process. He got it straight away. He didn't resign. Still, go and see him every now and again. He's a specialist now, very successful, yeah, very successful father and a husband. But anyway, to care is more important than curing. And also, that he cures many more people that way. It's a higher success rate. When you don't have these terrible interventions, cure at all costs, and sacrifice caring for somebody. And that's always the same with whatever person you have. I tell husbands and wives, wives, you will never ever be able to cure your husband. You've been trying for years, you should realize by now, you can't do that. But you can care for him. And then actually, he gets cured. So anyway, back to those empathy questions. How does that relate to meditation? Now is the most important time, obviously. What are you aware of right now? Whatever it is the most important meditation object in the world. Don't try and get rid of it. So you're sleepy. That's important for you. Don't stigmatize it. Don't diminish its importance. If it's right in front of your mindfulness in this moment, it is the most important meditation object in the whole world for you. Which means you are really mindful for a change. You're not trying to get rid of it, but being with something, give it importance. I notice that when I'm looking at you, I'm giving you importance, I'm reading you, we're connecting. And I've got to connect with my meditation object, no matter what it is. I don't choose it. It like chooses me. If it's right in front of me right now, it's the most important thing in the whole world. What do I do with it? Just care for it. It's beautiful kindness, embracing. Open the door of my heart to this moment. And you'll find from that beginning exercise of looking at your body, relaxing it, when you care for a feeling in your body which is painful, which is irritating, you really care for it. Not try and get rid of it. Open the door of your heart for it. It eases off. It becomes less painful. And people email these amazing stories. The one I always remember is this lady in Poland who said, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. She followed my meditation techniques. And she said she was suffering, an elderly woman suffering from this very, very terrible, what's it called, arthritis. Having to take very, very strong painkillers with very nasty side effects just to get through the day, just to survive. She says she doesn't need to take those painkillers anymore because the arthritis is totally gone. The inflammation has vanished through this meditation. When I read her email, it's just, you feel you've done something. You've taken away huge pain, or rather this meditation has, by caring, not trying to cure. So whatever you're experiencing, that is one of the most powerful, direct ways of meditation. Empathy questions meditation. Now the most important time. Forget about later on. Right now, what are you aware of? That is the most important meditation object in the whole world. And just care for it. It is amazing just how you just go through all these stages of meditation really quickly and powerfully. So you can try that one. That's one of the best. Okay. Yes?
Ajahn Brahm, I'd like to ask, following on your talk at Melbourne Union, just to comment about, you know, what you said a while ago about corporate America, and also just from today, you seem to be using a lot of emotional intelligence and loving kindness in your sort of method. Would that, in a sense, be part of evolving, or, you know, like, how do we say, like, you know, meeting the needs of the evolving society? Because I tend to find that, like you just said, mindfulness, meditation, all these labels and terms tend to become a very diluted or abused terminology in modern day society. And I'm just wondering, in comparison, because I actually was, in a sense, blown away by a very small little book by a teacher, and that's how I got to know you as well. And I'm just wondering, in comparison with regards to the way you were taught meditation and the way we are taught meditation today, as an example, just in comparison, would that be a dilution, and how? What are your thoughts on that with regards to, you know?
Well, one of the things which was a dilution, I went to many meditation teachers, and one of the big things with Ajahn Chah is so much fun, so much joy. It was great to be around. And so that meant that meditation was not like some places where it's so serious, sit up, don't smile. And I didn't know why, there's something wrong there. And no, you're hurting, sit through the hurt, don't move. You namby-pamby cream puff weakling, as if the meditation was only for like US Marines who could fight through pain. There's something wrong there. I didn't really understand why or what it was. And then eventually, you know, you go back to how the Buddha taught. Second factor of the Eightfold Path, core Buddhist teachings. And that second factor of the Eightfold Path, I call it right motivation, samasankappa. It's coming from a place of nekama, which is letting go. From kindness, avayapada, metta, loving kindness, compassion. I always wonder, where's the compassion in the Eightfold Path? And there it was, right in the middle of the second factor. Because that's what really motivated me, inspired me with Buddhism. It was a kind path. We didn't have people killing one another or torturing one another. It was kind. And the last of the third factor of the Eightfold Path was ahimsaka sankappa. And I knew that from the teachings of Gandhi. Ahimsa, non-violence, non-harm. And I saw these Zen masters hitting one another over the back with sticks. See people shouting at one another. That's not Buddhism. It's violent. And I saw monks doing violence to their own bodies, sitting through the pain. And what are you doing that for? That's not Buddhism. That's not the Dhamma. So that is one of the things which is missing, which I try and introduce as much as possible. The happiness, the kindness, the softness, the non-violence. The encouraging people, not forcing them. Just like I said, why did your mind wander off? Don't beat it. You wandered off again, you fell asleep. Let yourself fall asleep. Be kind. And you find that then you don't fall asleep anymore. And be gentle, be forgiving. Then you find your body relaxes. And you can meditate for hours then. So sometimes those are the things which took me many years to understand as a monk. It's not something you can just teach by being accredited as a mindfulness teacher by going for a course in the United States and paying about $10,000 for it. Something which is far better. And monks like me, there's many people who teach meditation in a nice way. We don't charge. We undercut the market. And that's one of the amazing things that we can do. We give it out for free, and I encourage you to do the same. That's the most radical thing we can do. But unfortunately, there are some people, and this has happened to me, they give you a call. And they said, you Ajahn Brahm, said, yes, I hear you teach meditation. Yeah, I do. He said, how much do you charge? I say, nothing. And they said, well, you can't be any good then. I mean, that's a terrible part of our society. You know, I've got enough cred, enough best-selling books. I could actually go and hire a hotel in Melbourne and charge people like, $5,000 for these 2 days, and I get a full hall. You could do that, and you can justify it raising money for the BSV, but to me that's immoral. You know, I was given these teachings for free, and they should be shared for free. So that's one of the great things that we can do, not just to get the teachings more full, but to share them for free. So anyway, these days I've got my own little trick. Instead of when people ring me up now and say, how much do you charge? The answer is, these teachings are priceless. Which means free, but it doesn't mean worthless. Priceless. But yeah, I share your concerns, and but we're getting there. So there's another question over here. Make it
Ajahn, just for a moment. We have 8 questions that have already come.
Okay, that'll be for after lunch.
Okay.
It's supposed to be lunchtime now, so one more question.
And we have a box just outside the door here on the left-hand side for you to put your questions in.
Very good, excellent. So one more question, then we start for lunch. Really great questions. Whoever gets a hand up highest. So, yeah.
Thank you, Ajahn, for being here and for sharing your wisdom with us. Just a follow-up question on what you said about care and opening our heart.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, do you have more insights as to, is there any more specific way as to how to care better and how to open our heart better? Or is it just simply a matter of when we open our heart, we'll have that inner wisdom as to how to care?
Okay, now a good example of that is that when I was in, what's it called, some hospital in Hong Kong with nurses and counsellors and that sort of not the main, there's a few doctors there, but it's mostly the secondary staff. You shouldn't really call them secondary, but I think you know what I mean. And so we did a little play acting. I split people up, paired them off, A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B, so pair off. And whoever's A, I want, you know, you've been in the health profession long enough, you must have seen someone with a heart attack. When I ring the bell, I want you to pretend to play having a heart attack. And the B person, I want you to respond. And so they were chatting to each other, rang the bell, well, I forget what they did. And they fell to the floor. And the B person said, stay with me, keep your eyes open, we've got the ambulance coming, don't do anything, we're okay, you're okay, you're okay. And then we did the debriefing afterwards. To the person A, how did it feel when somebody was talking to you like that? And they said it was just so disturbing. They were dying. And they wanted to die in their own way without being interfered with so much. So when they started again, they reversed roles. When I rang the bell, the B person had a heart attack and they died. And then the other person was just so much more caring. It's okay. Even their voice changed to something soft. It's okay. Ambulance will be coming soon. Because they realized the importance of caring rather than keeping a person alive at all costs. At all costs, the costs of destroying your dying moment, which is a very personal, beautiful thing. You know, how many times have you seen, I've seen this so often, you know, because this is part of my job. You're around your mum's bedside, and she's dying. You don't know when she's going to die, so you stay by there, and she's taking forever to die. And so, you go and get something to eat quickly. And as soon as you're out the room, she dies. When you're not there, because she needs to do it alone, privately. So that's one example that sometimes we interfere. When I die, I don't want you all saying, Ajahn Brahm, you can't die, we need you next year for WASAC, don't do it. Come butt out. It's my death, not yours. So I think you get the message there. That's one example. Okay, so I'm going to have my lunch now. So we're not going to have an arms round because we just keep it nice and simple. So those of you who want to come with me, we offer the tables and I take my bowl, take the first choice, not that much, and then have our lunch together. Very good.